Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran slams Israel's outrageous allegations against Tehran, saying such remarks are aimed at deflecting attention from the regime's atrocities in the region. Israel's prime minister submits a bill to dissolve the parliament after his coalition cabinet collapses, paving the way for the regime's fifth elections in 3 years. Also, Russia's former president dismisses nuclear arms reduction talks with the U.S. as pointless, saying Moscow should wait until the Americans beg for negotiations. It's good to have you with us. Iran slams Israel's quote outrageous allegations against the country, saying the regime wants to deflect attention from its atrocities in the region. Iran's UN ambassador says Israel is infamous for its racist policies and hate speech and cannot hide this fact through propaganda. Majid Takhravanchi was responding to anti-Iran allegations by Israel's representative at a UN meeting marking the first International Day for Countering Hate Speech. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian envoy warned against the growing trend of Islamophobia, saying such tendencies lead to violent extremism and threaten the security of all societies. He cited the politicization and restriction of the hijab, the burning of the Holy Quran, and the desecration of Islamic symbols and holy sites in some countries. Takhravanchi blamed this situation on anti-Muslim media outlets and civic groups promoting Islamophobia in the West. He also lamented the lack of resolve on the part of certain governments to confront hate speech and acts of hate against Muslims. Also, in another address to the UN Security Council, Iran's envoy condemned Israel's continued attacks on Syrian civilians and infrastructure, particularly the recent strike on Damascus International Airport. Iran's UN ambassador described Israeli attack on Syria as malign and an act of terrorism. Majid Takhravanchi said Israel's raids violate international law and Syria's sovereignty while jeopardizing regional stability and security. Expressing Iran's support for Syria, the envoy said Damascus has a legitimate right to defend itself in line with international law and the UN Charter. The Iranian envoy also called on the UN Security Council to abandon its double standards by unequivocally condemning the repeated Israeli aggressions and holding the regime accountable. Syrian air defenses have succeeded in intercepting the majority of missiles fired by Israeli aircraft, though they still cause material damage and casualties. Damascus says the Israeli attacks are carried out in support of terrorist groups in the Arab country. Last week, Russia summoned Israel's ambassador over recent airstrikes against Damascus International Airport. The leaders of Israel's fragile coalition cabinet are set to submit a bill to dissolve the parliament, paving the way for the fifth general elections in 3 years. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and his foreign minister, Yair Lapid, made the announcement in a Monday statement. The regime's top officials admitted that the decision came after all options to keep the coalition cabinet failed. The bill, which will be submitted next week, will make Bennett the regime's shortest-serving premier. Lapid will take over as the interim premier until the next election, which is scheduled for October 25th. Israel's fragile eight-party coalition was formed in June 2021 after four successive inconclusive elections. It lost its majority in Israel's parliament in April when a member of Bennett's Yamina party announced her departure. June 20th marks World Refugee Day. For Palestinians, the day is an occasion to review a history of displacement, dispossession, and suffering under Israeli occupation. We were earlier joined by our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, to get a picture of the situation of displaced Palestinians.
World Refugee Day is another reminder for the world about the suffering of refugees in general and Palestinians in particular. They've been displaced and dispossessed for more than 74 years. On May 15th, Palestinians marked the 74th anniversary of Nakba Day, of the catastrophe, referring to the displacement, disposition, and the massacre of Palestinians in 1948 upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Currently, there are 6 million registered Palestinian refugees around the world, according to UNRWA, the United Nations Refugee Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. But Palestinians say that the number is much higher because not all Palestinian refugees and their descendants have been registered with UNRWA. Gaza is home to more than 1.3 million Palestinian refugees out of a population of nearly 2 million. The suffering is much higher in Gaza. They've been under blockade since 2007. They have faced 4 Israeli wars since 2008.
Russia has dismissed nuclear arms reduction talks with the U.S. as pointless, saying Moscow should wait until Washington begs for negotiations. The comment was made by former president and currently deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev. He said there is no need to negotiate nuclear disarmament with the U.S. yet, adding that it was bad for Russia. Medvedev said everything is now at a dead zone between Washington and Moscow, as the two countries, quote, do not have any relations, as Russia's president Medvedev signed New START in 2010 with then U.S. President Barack Obama. The treaty was extended in 2021 for 5 years. Fears of a renewed arms race are now on the rise amid critically low relations between Moscow and Washington over the war in Ukraine. Russia and the U.S. are the world's biggest nuclear powers, which control about 90% of the global atomic arsenal. The Russian military presses ahead with its operation to take Ukraine's eastern region of Donbas. In the latest development, Russia and its allies have made advances in areas near the flashpoint city of Severodonetsk. Pro-Russian forces say they have gained control of the town of Tushkivka. Kiev has confirmed that. It has also acknowledged reports that Russian forces have captured the settlement of Metyulkina on Severodonetsk's eastern outskirts. Kiev says Russian forces have stepped up their shelling in Donetsk as well as Kharkiv in the northeast. President Volodymyr Zelensky says he expects Russia to intensify its attacks as Ukraine awaits the European Union's decision on its candidacy bid. EU leaders will discuss Kiev's membership at their summit this week. The country applied to join the bloc just a few days after Russia launched its war on February 24th. Barely 2 weeks ago, the British Prime Minister survived a potentially lethal challenge to his leadership. Boris Johnson narrowly made it through the Conservative MP's vote of no confidence in the House of Commons. And yet Johnson has decided to take on new challenges instead of talking about the Partygate scandal and his actions during the coronavirus pandemic.
Considering the latest controversies around Johnson, the British Prime Minister seems to be taking full advantage of a strategy known as the dead cat strategy in order to divert media attention away from problems or failures in other areas. Just a week after the vote of confidence, the British Prime Minister and his government are provoking other crises. Johnson says he wants to focus on what the people of the country want. And the first two issues which he has decided to tackle are the controversial matters of changing trade rules for Northern Ireland and flying refugees to Rwanda, both cases that thrust Britain into a nasty web of legal disputes that risk making the country look like an international scofflaw. With his leadership in peril, Johnson summoned his trusted advisors, and among those experts is political strategist Linton Crosby, a master of so-called wedge issues that divide national opinion. Such strategies are typically used to galvanize working-class voters. The most divisive wedge issue is asylum seekers, as Crosby clearly demonstrated in his experience with the Australian premiership, winning him many victories some 2 decades ago. So it wasn't a coincidence that a few days after their meeting, Home Secretary Priti Patel's floundering plan to export asylum seekers to Rwanda was revived. But at what cost has the British Prime Minister risked turning the UK into a pariah?
The controversy surrounding it is becoming more of a legal battle We have seen the European Court of Human Rights intervening in the issue based on, you know, filing from some of those affected by the decision, some of the asylum seekers. And I wonder if the UK really became a pariah state under Mr. Johnson, because this is not the first time he is going against international law.
The chartered Boeing 767 booked to take asylum seekers to Rwanda was a fiasco. It didn't take off thanks to a last-minute intervention from the European Court of Human Rights.
The UK has in essence thrust itself against the European Court of Human Rights on Rwanda agreement, which stipulates that refugees to Britain will be deported to the African country and receive asylum procedures. The controversial £120 million or pound deal is coming under heavy criticism in regard to its legality.
The British government's first attempt of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda came to a halt on Tuesday after the European Court of Human Rights intervened and forced the UK to abandon the flight. The intervention has, however, drawn frustration from British ministers who insist the plan was lawful. Britain's failed attempt has also led to officials proposing alternatives that would allow the UK to ignore the ECHR. Johnson himself defended the plan, saying it was completely legal.
Every single court in this country said, you know, there was no obstacle that they could see. Nobody in this country, no court in this country, ruled the policy unlawful, which was very, very encouraging.
Johnson described the order by the European Human Rights Court to stop the scheduled deportation of a handful of migrants as a weird last-minute hiccup. The United Nations refugee chief has, on the other hand, called it catastrophic. Following the ECHR's decision, British courts now have to clarify whether this practice is lawful.
When it comes to the issue of asylum seekers being exported by his government out of the UK to the to Rwanda, 1,000 miles away in Africa, that's actually illegal. We have heard this characterization of the issue as illegal from the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission, from multitude of international rights.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his government have spent much of this week battling with the EU and rowing with the European Human Rights Tribunal while playing down accusations that they are breaking international law and bow to the base of his party. On Monday, Johnson's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss revealed the long-awaited Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, a bill which, if passed, would allow the UK government to unilaterally cancel parts of the Brexit deal he struck with the EU in 2019. 2 days later, the EU reacted by launching legal action against the UK for its failure to implement parts of the protocol to date, while the Vice President of the European Commission stated that there is no legal or policy justification whatsoever for unilaterally modifying an international agreement. That is illegal. But the Prime Minister's willingness to have public spats with large international institutions seems typical of him. The Rwandan deportations and the renewed issue of Northern Ireland just seem to be radicalization of British politics, where Johnson tries to stay in power with new crisis.
Belgian police says tens of thousands of people took part in a march through Brussels on Monday demanding government measures to offset record high inflation. This is why the European Union comes under mounting pressure for spending billions of euros on arming Ukraine at a time when the bloc's citizens are struggling to make ends meet. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Tens of thousands of union members marched through Brussels city centre on Monday, calling for more support to deal with the cost of living, which is rising by the day. Inflation in Belgium has hit 9%. The Eurozone average is 8.1%.
The prices of electricity, water, all the supplies are going up, and the wages stays the same.
I have a bill to pay 6,000 euro for gas and electric. That's not normal.
All the other costs are very high. Energy, electricity, gas, but also food.
It's cheaper if I stay home than if I go and to work. That's not good.
The demonstration was organized to coincide with a national one-day strike. Belgium has been brought to a standstill by this strike. Trains, trams, metros and buses are not operating. All of the departing flights from the main airports in Zaventem and Charleroi have been cancelled, impacting an enormous number of passengers, including would-be holidaymakers. Western nations are sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro. Those on strike insist there is too much emphasis on war and not enough on diplomatic negotiations.
There is a NATO rule which says that each country has to invest 2% of their budget on military stuff. I think this is completely useless.
They have money to send to Ukraine for sophisticated weapons. It will cost a lot. And they say they don't have enough money to support us.
All of them, they just have blood on their hands. I think that's the real problem. And high society who is just making profit of all of that.
Unions in Belgium are warning of more strikes during the summer if the national government and EU authorities fail to ease cost-of-living pressures. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Tunisia's president has received the draft of the new constitution that would increase his powers less than a month before a referendum on the document. After receiving the draft on Monday, President Kais Saied said some chapters needed amendments. Saied has until June 30th to approve or edit the draft, which has not yet been disclosed to the public. He intends to put the new constitution to a referendum on July 25th. The opposition has said it will boycott the plebiscite, while thousands of Tunisians protested against the referendum over the weekend. The president has already appointed a new electoral commission, casting doubts on the credibility of any vote. He also has appointed a temporary judicial council and sacked dozens of judges. Saied seized the executive power last year, dissolving the parliament and ruling by decree in a move described by his opponents as a coup. Well, that's a wrap for this hour's World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It is now the duty of international community, including the oil-rich Arab regimes, which bow on the altar of U.S. Zionist devilishness, to awaken from slumber and come forward to help resolve the crisis in Rakhine and provide means for the safe return home of the Rohingya Muslims. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading Rohingya Muslims, a wait in vain, end of nightmare. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The West may be busy dealing with the war with Russia, into which it has dragged Ukraine. But the far more graver crises in other parts of the world, even though deliberately ignored by the so-called international media, are waiting for resolution. One such crisis, other than the chronic question of Zionist user Palestine, where the innocent are murdered at will almost every day by the US-backed Israelis, is the alarming situation of the Rohingya Muslims, both in their homeland Rakhine, from which many have been dislodged, and the million-plus languishing in the refugee camps of Bangladesh. It is indeed the worst human rights catastrophe of the contemporary world, as the UN has acknowledged, but it is either not fully committed to resolve it or is being prevented to do so by the powers that manipulate it. The fact cannot be denied that history's most evil empire, the United States of America, with its policy of devilish deception, political pressures, military threats, and economic terrorism, as is evident by the extraterritorial sanctions on nations refusing to bow to its blackmail, is also involved in the worsening plight of the Rohingyas. The first and foremost cause of the persecution and genocide of the Rohingyas in Myanmar, and the reluctance of the UN to seriously press for their repatriation back home, is the fact that these people happen to be Muslims. Thus, for the Americans and the Europeans, the repression of aliens of Rohingya Muslims is not a matter of concern, compared to the few thousand from other countries who have crossed borders into neighboring states. It is now almost a decade since the Myanmar military, along with chauvinistic Buddhist monks and the unprincipled politicians feigning to be Democrats, launched the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya Muslims in Rakhine. Since then, because of the frozen conscience of the world, their situation has sharply deteriorated and resulted in almost the mass migration to Bangladesh, where the million-odd refugees are to, unfortunately, mark their fifth year of homelessness next month, with no prospects for return. According to analysts, despite their deep passion to return home, the Rohingya Muslims in Bangladesh are faced with nothing but bad options. These include the return to the military regime-run resettlement camps with no rights but the risk of getting caught in the middle of brutal vendettas between the Arakan Army and the State Administration Council, whose vague promise of granting some sort of citizenship to the Rohingya Muslims cannot be trusted. The other bad option is to remain in the violence-ridden virtual concentration camps that Bangladesh has built around them in Cox's Bazar. As human beings, it is the desire of every Rohingya Muslim to reside in peace in Rakhine State and to return home with safety and dignity. It is now the duty of the international community, including the oil-rich Arab regimes, which bow on the altar of U.S. Zionist devilishness, to awaken from slumber and come forward to help resolve the crisis in Rakhine and provide means for the safe return home of the Rohingya Muslims.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Here is an interesting saying from Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Raza, peace be upon him, that says, "This world is a prison for a true believer, and a paradise for the unbeliever."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, the inner personality. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. When we look at our own selves and when we look at the people around us, we find that they have an external appearance which we see by their way of talking and moving, and which is clear to us, which is clear by when we look at them, when we by our senses. But there is another aspect of the people and our own selves, and it's our own inner personality. What is our inner personality? It's our moral values, its moral qualities, moral characters that make ourselves. If we look at people and we can look at ourselves, we find that our inner personality is made of the moral characters. What are moral characters and how they are made? And how they play their role in forming of our personality. We find that moral characters are actually divided into two types. The first type are called the excellences, or in other words, they are good moral qualities. And then on the other side, we have vices or bad moral qualities. These together make our personality, make what we are in real within ourselves. What we are really in our essence is comprised by our own moral characters, which we make gradually by our own intention and will. Welcome back. You are listening to A to Z. Well, we were talking about the moral character and moral qualities which make our inner personality, which make what we are really, what we are in our inner essence. So we told that those qualities are divided into moral excellences and moral vices. We today want to speak about how they are developed in our personality. Actually, they are developed in the result of our own actions, our own deeds. When we do practice a thing and repeat it for more and more times, it gradually becomes a habit. When we develop a habit and it becomes ingrained and rooted in our personality, and it becomes a part of ourselves, it becomes a character, it becomes a rooted habit. And it is what in Arabic called khuluq or malaka. It's called malaka or khuluq. And that rooted habit which make our real personality is made by our own selves. And that's the most important thing to know, that our akhira, our the hereafter, our reality will, when it will be revealed, these moral quality will be the standard and will be the criteria by which we will be a part of those people who are successful, or those who eventually end to failure. So the inner moral qualities are the very important things about our personality which we should work upon, and we should think about how to develop these moral excellences, how to avoid the vices. Inshallah, I'll ask Subhanahu wa Ta'ala that He help us walk on the path of excellences and to avoid the vices. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light. Five young and rare Bonelli's eagles born on a breeding farm in France are taking a journey to Spain, where they will be released into the wild. These eaglets were born in captivity, which is a rare feat for these endangered species. Three of the five are ready to be released and have been fitted with GPS microchips for tracking purposes. Their initial release date was delayed because of several weeks of bird flu, which made traveling impossible. The other two eagles are too young to be reintroduced and are still being hand-fed from behind the curtain. They will make the journey sometime in July. The breeders, however, are worried about how to sustain the program as their birds begin to age. Pacto says his five pairs of eagles are aged between 18 and 30 years, and three of them are now too old to breed. He says the number of Bonelli's eagles had dropped dramatically since the 1980s, mainly to electrocution on high voltage lines. Due to the reintroduction program, the population of these eagles has nearly doubled over the past two decades.
About a dozen penguins have been returned home after being given a second chance at life following their rehab in Argentina. The birds were rescued in the province of Buenos Aires and were transported to the Mundo Marino Foundation for evaluation. The Magellanic penguins were treated for malnutrition, dehydration and parasites. The foundation's director says these pathologies are usually caused by climate change, food scarcity and environmental pollution. Vets say they are seeing more and more of these sorts of rescues. The bears were nursed back to health in one of the foundation's facilities in the town of San Clemente del Tuyo. They were later released back to their habitat in southern Chile. People in Poland have rolled out flower carpets for the feast of Corpus Christi held in the central village of Spiszemierz. Families usually arrange colorful and symbolic carpets for the procession on the road section in front of their homes. They use flowers picked from the surrounding fields or their own gardens. They also use soil, sand and fresh cut grass. The procession begins from the church and roams the streets of the village. The flower carpets have been rolled out annually since the tradition started 200 years ago, except for once when a storm broke out.
This tradition is 200 years old, and according to what the village elders say, it has only happened once that there was no carpet of flowers for the procession, because a storm broke out and swept everything away in the afternoon.
Families begin collecting the flowers a few days before the feast and arrange it on the celebration day. Besides its religious aspect, the event is also meant to express appreciation for nature. The practice has been passed from generation to generation ever since it began. The tradition was registered at UNESCO's Cultural Heritage List last year.
Artists have turned a historic village in the Tunisian island of Djerba into a vibrant open-air art museum. The organizer of the project says he has always had a clear vision for the gallery.
The goal of this project is to create a new way of displaying urban art, to create a museum, a real museum, which labels for the works with a certain lighting, certain works and staging. Also to create a dynamic to give this museum to the residents so that they could appropriate it and it almost becomes their business.
The project is called Djerbehud and it's located in a town of Eriyadh. Since 2014, about 150 artists from 35 different nations have gathered there to produce eye-catching street art. Tourists say they enjoy visiting the gallery because they can see something new every time they come round. Residents of the town are also content with the vibrant looks of their streets, saying the artwork give a little movement to their everyday lives. Japanese engineers have invented a four-legged robot that can easily move across rough terrain while carrying heavy loads. Japan's Kawasaki Heavy Industries has developed a quadrupled robot, believing it can help meet labor shortage in the country's aging society. Dubbed Bex after the wild goat species Ibex, the robot features large curved horns. It can walk over rough terrain or move faster on smoother surfaces using wheels tucked in its underbelly. Bex was designed to perform tasks and carry humans in agricultural settings, thereby answering a labor crunch in rural Japan.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Another breakthrough in the world of science. Japanese scientists move one step closer to creating lifelike robots by changing their physical appearance. Researchers at the University of Tokyo have developed living skin on a robotic finger. To that aim, they have submerged the robot's finger into a cylinder filled with a mixture of the natural skin components. The lab-grown skin is water-repellent, has wrinkles, and can heal itself. A member of the research team explains how the innovation will be helpful in the future. Let's take a listen.
As for challenges in the future, since we've only produced a simple skin, we would like to add various sensory organs such as the nervous system and the vascular system. We would like to further improve the function of the skin. Once we complete that, I believe that the skin itself could be used for transplantation, or use the skin as a model to develop cosmetics or drugs, or for leather products that do not require harming the animal, or to cover prosthetic limbs and legs.
The lab-grown skin is much weaker than the natural type. It's unable to survive long without nutrient supply and waste removal. For now, the team plans to address those issues and also include more sophisticated features. They want to add hair follicles, sweat glands, and sensory neurons to the skin. A Belgian company is trying to combat urban waste by transforming used coffee grounds into edible mushrooms that can also be used in construction. The mycelium is grown in a damp cellar in Brussels. Some 5 tons of coffee grounds are collected each month from partner cafes. They are then mixed in drums where the oyster mushroom spores are added and mixed with straw in a sack. The mushrooms emerge from slashes in the sacks 15 days afterwards and are ready to be sent to shops for sales. The business owners say they are looking to expand their business and use coffee and mushrooms as an environmentally friendly alternative to plastic.
Each day we throw away a lot of coffee, and this coffee to be produced needs a lot of energy from the cultivation to the transportation to Europe, and it's just a pity not to use it more than a few minutes to drink a coffee.
The company has already tested out its fungus-based insulating tiles and received its first order of these tiles for soundproofing purposes. Jacket says they hope to produce 12 tons of the mycelium material per month when they gather enough investment. The business owner says there is no shortage of raw material as coffee is widely consumed in Belgium. Jacket says the innovation can dramatically cut down on plastic waste.
China launches 3 astronauts to its Tiangong space station as its construction enters a critical phase. The 3 blasted off from a launch center in northwestern China. They are the second group of astronauts to head to the space station since its construction began in April 2021. They will stay there for 6 months. The space station is planned as a 3-section structure. The core module was launched in April, and 2 more components will be sent into space in July and September. The new mission will oversee the integration of the 3 parts. The crew's commander has described the task as a pivotal battle in the construction of Tiangong, which is planned to be completed by the end of 2022.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to 2 more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
We have found 2 additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial-era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose Galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there will be many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warn that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
New scientific research published recently shows the waters in the North Barents Sea are warming at a rate that is much more rapid than most climate models have predicted, with worrying implications about feedback loops for the larger Arctic region and far beyond. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Coyley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Off the Scale, Warmer Arctic Ocean Fueling Climate Feedback Loop Faster Than Previously Known. Here's more. New scientific research published recently shows the waters in North Barents Sea are warming at a rate that is much more rapid than most climate models have predicted, with worrying implications about feedback loops for the larger Arctic region and far beyond. Extending between the north coast of Norway and Russia in the eastern Arctic Ocean, the North Barents Sea has been warming at a rate nearly 7 times that of the global average, this study shows. The researchers used temperature data over 4 decades to determine that the trends in the region, the fastest warming place known on Earth, should be seen as an early warning of what could happen elsewhere. Published in Scientific Reports, the new findings offer further confirmation that feedback loops in the Arctic are taking hold, but could be doing so at a faster rate than previously understood. The warming pattern is primarily consistent with reductions in sea ice cover and confirms the general, spatial, and temporal patterns represented by reanalysis, states the abstract of the study, adding, however, our findings suggest even a stronger rate of warming and sea ice concentration and sea surface temperature relation than was known in this region until now. Researchers behind this study reports High North News warn the increased warming is likely to fuel increases in extreme weather in North America, Europe, and Asia. The scientists say the Barents Sea region offers a window into how warming is already impacting the Arctic more broadly and what more rapid warming can look like elsewhere in the future. We expected to see strong warming, but not on the scale we found, Ketil Isaken, a senior researcher at the Norwegian Meteorological Institute, who led the study, told The Guardian. "We were all surprised," he added. "We were surprised from what we know from all other observation points on the globe. These are the highest warming rates we have observed so far," he said. The broader message is that the feedback of melting sea ice is even higher than previously shown. "This is an early warning for what's happening in the rest of the Arctic if this melting continues and what is most likely to happen in the next decades." Bill McGuire, Emeritus Professor of Geographical and Geophysical Climate Hazards at the University of College London, said the findings were among the most dire he's ever seen. While land surface temperatures are rising and oceans warming across the globe, Isaksen said his team's research helps show what's happening in the far northeast of the scale. As The Guardian reports, it was already known that the climate crisis was driving heating across the Arctic 3 times faster than the global average, but the new research shows the situation is even more extreme in places. Sea ice is good at reflecting sunlight but is melting away. This allows the darker ocean below to absorb more energy. Losing sea ice also means it no longer restricts the ability of warmer sea waters to heat up the Arctic air. The more ice is lost, the more heat accumulates, forming a feedback loop. According to Dr. Ruth Mutarem, a climate scientist at the Danish Meteorological Institute, who was not part of the research team, this study shows that even the best possible models have been underestimating the rate of warming in the Barents Sea. "We seem to be seeing it shifting to a new regime as it becomes less like the Arctic and more like the North Atlantic," she told The Guardian. "It's really on the edge right now, and it seems unlikely that sea ice will persist in this region for much longer."
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, in light of the Iranian Foreign Minister's visit to India, we'll assess the opportunities and challenges ahead for the development of ties between the two nations. We'll also take a look at the worldwide protests of the Muslim community to derogatory comments made by BJP officials against the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and their implications for India.
On the 8th of June, the Iranian foreign minister, accompanied by a high-ranking delegation, visited New Delhi to meet with Indian politicians, trade officials and other notable dignitaries. During this visit, the two sides held extensive talks discussing various fields of interest, which showcased the willingness of both parties to expand ties on all fronts. Creating a blueprint for long-term cooperation between the two countries is one of the main objectives of this visit, apart from discussing recent global and regional developments. A goal that appears more necessary than ever in the aftermath of the economic stagnation that occurred in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic is solving conflicts in Europe and the global food and energy crisis.
Looking at historical context, Iran and India have maintained long-lasting ties, but these ties have been subjected to global and regional developments of recent decades, causing a fluctuation in bilateral relations. India is a newly emerging superpower that the IMF predicts will become the third global economic powerhouse by 2025 after the US and China. The requirement for long-term energy supplies as the fourth consumer of oil after China, US and Russia means it cannot ignore Iran, which holds the world's second largest reserve of natural gas and the third largest oil reserves. 2 days before his speech at GlobeSec 2022 in Bratislava, Jaishankar stated, "If the US and Europe want to limit other countries' imports from Russia, they must bring Iran and Venezuela as alternative import options back to the table." From another perspective, access to countries in West Asia, Europe and the Persian Gulf is an important objective for India that can be best achieved through Iran. The visit by the Iranian foreign minister and his accompanying delegation and the talks held with high-ranking Indian officials come at a time when the global food and energy crisis caused by the Russia-Ukraine war is heralding new challenges for India, like many other nations. On the other hand, a balanced approach to foreign policy and mutual political security and economic interests necessitates the furthering of ties between Iran and India if they aim to achieve mutual goals.
India considers Iran a significant supplier of energy and a bridge to reach Afghanistan, West Asia and Europe. For the Islamic Republic, India is one of the countries that can help Iran achieve its look to the east policy. Meanwhile, shared concerns for security in Afghanistan and Central Asia, along with India's policy to balance relations between the east and the west, have made Iran a focal point in India's global and regional politics.
We can trace India's interest in Central Asia to the economic and cultural exchanges along the ancient Silk Road. These exchanges that include all aspects of politics, economy and culture in conjunction with India-Pakistan's deteriorating ties have arguably made Chabahar port the best or perhaps the only viable access point for India in its attempts to reach Afghanistan and other Central Asian countries. Moreover, access to Europe and increasing India's influence and power in the Persian Gulf and West Asia would prove most difficult without proper cooperation and coordination with Iran. In pursuit of clear geopolitical and geoeconomic gains, especially when it comes to the Chabahar project, the Indian government has inked several cooperation agreements with Iran over the past two decades. The Chabahar port is one of the main variables that can lead to improved economic relations and subsequently the formation of a lasting political link between Iran, India and Afghanistan, a link that New Delhi seems to pursue as one of its priorities in its policies toward the new Iranian government.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Karim Sharara, an Iranian affairs expert from Beirut, Lebanon. Now, Mr. Sharara, welcome to the program. Now, considering furthering political and economic ties can be beneficial to both Iran and India, how do you assess the prospects of cooperation between the two nations?
Okay, I think both countries stand to gain a lot from cooperation with one another. On the one hand, of course, Iran, as President Raisi has said time and time again, is trying to increase its cooperation with its neighboring countries. So on the one hand, you have the relationship with the Axis of Resistance or countries that are that have very strong relations with Iran. So we're talking here about Iraq, Syria, and the strategic depth that Iran has in the region, in West Asia, I mean. And on the other hand, you also have Central Asia, which, I mean, I'm just talking about where Iran is concerned at the moment. So we're talking Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and of course, we're talking about China. Now, there's a lot we can talk, we can say about China, but as far as India is concerned, India is one of the most important countries in the world right now after China. And of course, it isn't just fine with remaining a super or a very strong regional power close to superpower status in South Asia, increase its clout in Central Asia. One of the impediments towards that relationship, towards that, towards it, it attaining